It is February 2nd, and this week on The Breezy Breakfast, we hear from University of Guelph activist Gabriel Aladua. Gabriel shares his thoughts on the role of migrant workers in the Canadian agricultural economy. Gabriel reflects on why migrant workers come to Canada, the conditions in which they work, and why the migrant worker program needs to be examined and improved. Over to our moderator, Phil Ault.
Good morning and welcome to this Breezy Breakfast. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge that Guelph is situated on the ancestral homelands of the Anishinaabeg peoples, specifically the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation. I would further like to recognize that Canada continues to address past injustices to First Nations, including the abuse and death of many children who resided in and attended residential schools. Land acknowledgement must be a growing, living recognition that truth and reconciliation will be a dynamic process in which many past indignities are discovered, addressed, and ultimately for which many Indigenous people must be compensated. Today we are joined by University of Guelph activist and resident Gabriel Aladua. I first met Gabriel when my wife Liz and I were honored to host many migrant workers who were promoting the film Migrant Dreams, directed and produced by Min Suk Lee. Migrant Dreams was the winner of two prestigious awards for documentary film, the 2017 Hillman Prize for Journalism and the 2016 CWA-CAJ Award for Labor Reporting. The film chronicles the challenges and the anguish faced by migrant workers in Canada's food industry. Gabriel played a key role in raising awareness about how food is grown, harvested, and processed in Canada before it gets to market. Migrant workers are involved in all aspects of food processing in this country. Often they face unsafe conditions and are subject to human rights and labor abuses. Health and safety issues, visa concerns, economic exploitation are sadly the foundations of the job Gabriel currently holds. He is an activist for human rights and equality at the University of Guelph. I think it is fitting that we hear from Gabriel today on our first Breezy Breakfast of Black History Month. Many migrant workers working in Canada are of African and slave heritage, but living in the Caribbean and required by Canadian law to return there. Until just a few years ago, Gabriel was one of them. Through sheer perseverance and stubborn will to challenge Canada's indentured worker program, Gabriel was finally able to gain that which many workers seek, the status of landed immigrant, with a future extending beyond the work camps that originally brought him here and which took him from St. Lucia. Gabriel, welcome to Breezy Breakfast. We are very glad to hear from you about this and your current campaigns, your personal struggle, and of course about this particular book, which you have co-written and which my wife Liz purchased at the bookshelf. And I don't know what Liz is trying to say to me in the background there.
It's upside down.
Oh, it's upside down. It's upside down. That's what she's saying. Harvesting Freedom is a must read. And I think actually I'm going to take just a couple of seconds just to read from the introduction. Gabriel's story puts a human face to the tens of thousands of migrant workers who toil annually in Canada's fields, factories, family homes, and fast food restaurants. Valued for their labor, but almost never welcome to join Canadian society, quote, good enough to work, but not good enough to stay, to invert a common refrain from activists, migrant workers often come off in public discourse as an undifferentiated mass, known purely as laborers rather than as human beings, an impression that the oft-used acronym TFW, or Temporary Foreign Worker, only further solidifies. Gabriel's story makes such an impression impossible. Today, welcome Gabriel, and we'd love to hear more from you and possibly even hear about how others can purchase this important reading on Canada's food safety network. Welcome, Gabriel.
Yeah, thank you so much, Phil, and thanks for this great opportunity. I want to say Canada on the world stage portrays itself as a multicultural a champion for human rights. But in truth and in fact, there are lots of people who do not have the freedom to speak. So I welcome this opportunity. In my opinion, from my experience, the loudest voice in Canada, the most common language in Canada is not English, is not French, is not Spanish. From my experience, the loudest voice, the most popular language in my world is the voice of the marginalized and the suppressed, those who are suppressed, and we are all migrant workers. So thank you for this great opportunity. Being a migrant farm worker in Canada, both our living and working conditions are extremely, extremely challenging. I want to tell you, and I want all Canadians to know, in Canada, it is legal to exploit the soil. In Canada, it is legal to exploit the environment. In Canada, it is legal to exploit migrant workers. I want to tell you another important reason why I'm really thankful for this opportunity. A lot of people are not concerned whether the food is being grown by those who exploit the soil, exploit the environment, exploit the workers. But this opportunity helps me to connect with people who increasingly want to know more about the food, how it is grown, whether it's grown by those who respect the soil, respect the environment, respect the workers. And the other important thing is the food that we eat can be our safest form of our medicine, and it can also be our slowest form of poison. So are we concerned about our food? Let us go to the life of a migrant worker. Our living conditions, generally our living conditions, one, we live in very isolated housing. Actually, we live on the farm. So we are the farmer's property. We are property in Canada. And a lot of the farms, you'd see private property, no trespassing, and so on. So we are basically property. That's one. Number two, we are isolated. Number three, we live in overcrowded housing. And we know with COVID, how overcrowded housing is one of the recipe for COVID to spread. And with COVID, not only can we get sick, but we can also die. So we come to Canada, not only at the risk of our health, but also we are also risking our life. And in terms of our housing, a lot of the times it is not regulated. That's just housing. If you take working conditions, we do not have the same protections that Canadians have. And what are those protections? For example, holiday pay, overtime pay, and so many of the protections that Canadians enjoy, we do not have that. It takes me to the three pillars of the program. From 1966 to now, the three pillars of that program. What are the three pillars of the program that brought me to Canada? One, we are here to do jobs Canadians do not want to do. And what are those jobs? The dirty, the difficult, the dangerous, and the deadly jobs. And just for emphasis, during the pandemic, unemployment was at its highest in Canada. I thought Canadians would go to the farm during the pandemic to produce their own food. Nope. Even during a pandemic, during crisis, Canadians do not want to do it. Why? The conditions are not right. And during the pandemic, we saw that there are no migrant workers in Canada. Why? Because we got a promotion. What's the promotion? We are called essential workers. The country cannot work without us. But that was just a deceptive promotion. Nice words, but where are the actions to back it up? So one, we are here to do jobs Canadians do not want to do. That's one. Number two, the second pillar of the program, we cannot apply for status. In Canada, if you have status, you have rights. If you have status, you have rights. In Canada, status is a two-edged sword. What is a two-edged sword? People with status, if I have status, it takes care of my immigration vulnerability and my labor vulnerability. Let me explain a little. If I have status, I'm not concerned about being deported or sent back home because status protects my immigration vulnerability. One of the injustices that we face is the threat of deportation keeps us quiet. So if I have status, I can speak up without any threat of being sent back home. That's one. If I have status, I have an open work permit. Right now, being a migrant farm worker, it means I am tied to my employer. And by being tied to my employer, I have to please my employer. But if I have an open work permit, the pressure would be now on my employer to create the conditions to attract me and keep me. If I have an open work permit, my employer knows I can work if anybody is willing to hire me. But being tied to my employer, there's no pressure on my employer to create conditions that are fair and just. So number one, We are here to do jobs Canadians do not want to do. Number two, we do not have status. And not having status, as I said, status is a two-edged sword. It takes care of our immigration and labor vulnerabilities. Not having status means we are denied both labor standards and human rights, basic human rights. Number three, we are tied to our employer by way of a tied work permit. We can only work for that person whose name is on our work permit. Let me go over that again. The three pillars of the program: to be tied to our employer through a tied work permit, to do the dirty work, and at the same time being denied status means denied basic labor standards, basic human rights. That's the labor program. In Canada, I want to say quickly here, in Canada, and that's enshrined in Canadian law. Is that an accident or is that by design? According to enshrined in Canadian law, who's a migrant worker? Another name for migrant worker, enshrined. That's enshrined in Canadian law. Is denied. We are denied the right to vote. The same politicians who create those unjust laws, unjust policies, we cannot vote for them. We cannot vote against them because we deny the right to vote. That's one. Being a migrant worker, we are denied the right to participate in family life. In family life. Does that make us a human being in Canada? And that's enshrined in Canadian law. Being a migrant worker, we're denied the right to be protected by ordinary labor standards. And that's enshrined in Canadian law. Does that make us a human being? And is that an accident? That's one. Let me go to buy local. And the way it's presented to us, it is such a nice package. Buy local. I love buy local. Buying local means supporting the local economy, buying freshness. And the fresher the goods, the more healthy, the more nutritious it is. But what does buy local mean? Buy local means, you know what it means? That every time we buy local fruits and vegetables, once migrant workers are involved in the production of these fruits and vegetables, there are 20 injustices, and those injustices, they are at every level of government. When we buy local, you know what they're saying? Canada is saying, when you buy local, Canada is saying, send me to the sending countries, send me people of color. So race is one of them. Black people, brown people, people of color, that's one. Number two, Canada is saying, I like when you send me those people of color, but the English is a problem for them. They struggle with English. English is a second language to them. So people of color and people who struggle with English. And number three, Canada is saying, send me those people of color, send me those people who don't know much about English, and send me those people who are ignorant about human rights issues and labor issues. Let me go over that again. Canada is saying, send me people of color, race, send me people who struggle with English, and send me people who are ignorant about human rights issues and labor issues. That's one. Canada welcomes us. Canada welcomes us in a climate of fear. There's a lot of fear in that program. And let me talk a little about fear. The threat of deportation is one of many aspects. Eh? The threat of deportation keeps us quiet. So they welcome us in a climate of fear. This is forcing us. We are forced to be compliant and submissive. Forced to be compliant and submissive. And where is that happening? Where is that happening? In a country with a culture of silence. Nobody speaks about it. That is why I welcome this opportunity to speak. How can we address it if we don't talk about it? And all of that is a legal program. So that is the FAM program in a nutshell. I want to tell you also, our injustices are at every level of government. And to address this problem, we are asking for status. By having status, as I said, it's a two-edged sword. It cuts both ways. What is both ways? Both our labor vulnerabilities and our immigration vulnerabilities. And the problem is being perpetuated by the politicians. Why this has been perpetuated? Because the consumers, we the public, we the consumers, we don't realize there's power in our hands. There's power in our hands as a consumer. There's power in our hands as a voter. There's power in our hands as an activist, as a artists, as a media person. There's power in our hands. The skills that we have, we can use it. The politicians keep saying, oh, that's not an issue in my writing. Nobody speaks about it. So I would like to use this opportunity to encourage people in radio land, people who can hear me, people who listen to this program, to use the power that's in your hands to push the politicians to change those unjust laws, unjust policies. In truth and in fact, Canada can be a truly multicultural society. In truth and in fact, Canada can be a fair and just society. The question is, are you willing to use the power in your hands to create that Canada that we all deserve? Thank you.
Thank you, Gabriel, for a very, very powerful introduction to the world of the migrant worker. I pulled together a number of questions, and I think the first one that I'm going to go to is one that came in last night from a regular attendee, Susan Rosenthal. And the question very simply is, what do you believe can be done to support migrant workers? You mentioned consumerism and you mentioned the ballot. What else can be done?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that can be done. Even this activity right now is one of the things that can be done. Let people know about the, you know, the real issues related to their food. So using the media is one. That's one. Talking to your families too. There are lots of documentaries like Migrant Dreams that people can watch with their family, because that could be a conversation at the dinner table, at the lunch table, at the breakfast table, having the conversation. But there are lots of other things that can be done. Writing, in the local papers. There's lots of things. And let me put it this way. It boils down to what skill that each individual have and using that skill. We can use our skill. I use my big mouth. That's what I have to create, to push the conversation. What skills that you have? And there's no limit. Do not limit yourself in the way that you can push the conversation. Actually, focus on yourself. What skill I have and how I can use it to push the conversation. Do not limit yourself. The opportunities are unlimited. Unlimited. It boils down to how your unique skills and how you can use it. Let me put it this way.
Okay, I'm going to come back to the big mouth because that's very important, I think. But before we do that, you just had mentioned Migrant Dreams, and I did want to talk a little bit about that, the film by Min Suk. You were at our house years ago, along with a number of other people promoting this film, and there were some very graphic moments, I would say, in that particular film of migrant workers' experiences, challenges with, as you said, family. I believe that there was a couple in that film that wanted to get married, for one, and the challenges of actually providing for family while living in Canada. I was wondering if you could just give us a quick synopsis of the film and what important elements of it you believe are worthwhile people seeing and how they would see it today.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. I just want to point out, Min Suk Lee, she has two powerful documentaries. The first one is El Contrato. That one focuses on the 8-month program, which is the one that I came under, the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program, El Contrato. It highlights the vulnerabilities of people on that 8-month program. And quickly, that 8-month program, it started from 1966. So this year it will be 57 years. That's one. Number two, under that program, we can spend a maximum of 8 months in Canada. And by December 15th, we have to go home. That's the 8-month program, we call it, or the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program. So a lot of the vulnerabilities are clearly highlighted in El Contrato. The second one, Migrant Dreams, that one is a slightly different program. It's called the agricultural stream. On that program, they come to Canada and spend 2 years. It's a 2-year contract. So it's a longer period than the 8 months. That's one. So that particular documentary, Migrant Dreams, it spells out the vulnerabilities of people on that program. Now, what are the vulnerabilities? One, it shows a lot that a lot of people from Thailand, the Philippines, and Guatemala, and so many other countries, they spend a lot of money to pay recruiters to come to Canada. Recruiters fee. Some people pay $8,000 and upwards of $8,000 to come to Canada. Now, $8,000 Canadian from a foreign country, that is a debt that it takes you several years to pay. And you come here with with a debt over your head. Now, one, listen to that. It is the employer who have to pay all the costs associated with recruiting the worker. So that's one. Already the workers are starting with a debt that they do not have to pay. So ignorance about the things, deception and exploitation is one of the challenges that are clearly highlighted there. That's one. Number two, in the documentary, you'd see how the workers rely on the employers for their status. is the employers who have to apply for the work permit and the visas and so on. And you can see in the documentary that because they spoke about the poor living and working conditions, that they were left stranded. They were deceived and they were left without status. So a lot of power, and that is what it is, high power imbalance. A lot of power is in the hands of the employer. And I was counting and I stopped at 20 injustices that at every level of government. And one of them is there's so much power in the hands of the employer. So I would encourage everybody to watch Migrant Dreams to see the vulnerabilities of workers. If you look at pesticides, which is also highlighted, even our working conditions, our living conditions are clearly highlighted in that documentary. And as I said also, El Contrato is another documentary that can, you know, bring home the point of the poor working and living conditions of migrant workers who are on the 8-month program.
Thank you, Gabriel. Now, normally I try to look at the chat and I get questions from Tanya or from Morgan who provide me with questions, but I'm going to try to put some people on the spot because there are a number of questions that come up. And the first one, I think if Jonathan Webb is ready, because on my screen, he's right beside you. Jonathan, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind asking the question that you've put into the chat for perhaps Gabriel to respond.
Yeah, thank you, Phil, for putting me on the spot. Gabriel, I just asked factual questions, actually. Trying to get a sense of the scale of the programs you're talking about. Can you give me an idea how many migrant workers are brought into the country each year? Right. What crops are dependent on them?
Okay, thank you so much. That is a nice... It sounds like the simplest question. It feels like I could close my eyes to answer that, but it's a difficult question because every year the numbers keep on increasing. But first of all, anything between 40,000 and 60,000 workers come to Canada every year. The important thing is the bulk of it, the lion's share comes to Ontario. What are the crops? I was reading a literature from the growers literature. There's a literature that they want to that they provide to educators, to schools, and the first line says migrant workers help in the cultivation of over 125 crops. Over 125. But let me tell you the few that I am familiar with. In the greenhouse, it's a lot of vegetables, tomatoes, cucumbers, sweet peppers. These are the common ones in the greenhouse. Outside, what are the common ones outside? Apple, pears, you know, cherries, the tree crops outside. And I worked on a vegetable farm, organic vegetable, and there were things like lettuce, a variety of crops, celery, lettuce, cabbages, I didn't even remember all the names, chard, you name it, a wide variety of vegetables, a lot of them. Other farms, they would have potatoes, tobacco. The list is very long. Niagara Falls, although we have a lot of grapes. So the list is extremely, extremely long.
Wow. I mean, basically the answer is everything.
Literally everything. Just the exception would be, you see things like corn and soya beans, the machines harvested, right? But besides that, everything that's manual. Yes.
I'd associated it largely with I've got family connections in the Okanagan Valley, and an uncle of my wife had a peach orchard. And they brought in people every year to help with the peaches. Now, I was going to say that I know they treated people well. In fact, my uncle, Vivian's uncle, ended up marrying one of the workers. But I dare say that's exceptional and it doesn't really address the problem.
Yeah, that's an exception for sure. And I wish that was the rule. And I wish it was based on love and not on exploitation, which is what the system is. Yeah, profit, profit, profit. Yeah.
It can be both love and exploitation, which is rather weird.
Unless some people love exploitation.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you greatly. Yes.
Gabriel, Tanya, who normally works behind background, has more than a couple of questions, but I think that they're excellent. And Tanya, I think it's best if perhaps you might want to ask one or two of those.
Sure. One thing I wanted to ask was, are there any inspections of the living quarters of migrant workers?
Surprisingly, yes. But a couple of buts. Eh? One, these inspections are carried out when the workers, before the workers arrive. So everything looks proper. That's one. Number two, the inspections, it vary from province or county to county. There have been cases where they said they use students. There are cases where they said during COVID it was done virtually. The inspections and the whole system, it's systemic, right? When I say systemic, there's connection with the employer and the people doing inspection. One phone call and they know, you know, the workers are never involved in those things. It's always the employer. And it is, who are the people doing the inspections? If you see some places that they've been passed, you're wondering, what are the standards? Are there any standards? You know, it's left. The word inspection is a very comforting word, but the question on paper, it's nice, but in practice, it's a different thing. And if I take you, if again, I'll draw your attention to migrant dreams. If you see the housing conditions that's highlighted right here in London, which is pretty close to you, you'd wonder, what is the definition of inspection?
I'm just going to quickly read from Harvesting Freedom. Gabriel, I hope that this doesn't stop people buying your book if I read generously from it. I hope it inspires them to read more. And just from a couple of points about your initial arrival in Canada. My welcome to Canada contrasted sharply with the ideas of the country I held up to that point, especially growing up. Throughout my schooling in St. Lucia, Canada was presented as a place of high standards. We admired Canada for its economy, education, healthcare, diversity, human rights, and agriculture. We were impressed by its expansive and beautiful geography. Now, flash forward to your arrival in Canada. If any of us were reassured when we got off the plane, it wore off quickly. The moment we stepped out of the airport and into the cold, mid-January night, we realized that we did not have the appropriate clothing to face the winter. In the long process of applying to and joining the program, no government official had prepared us for this crucial fact, let alone supplied us with any winter clothing. In that moment, the bitterly cold wind felt like a hard slap in the face. Relief from the cold would not come anytime soon. The bus that had been sent to take us to our assigned farm in Leamington, Ontario, did not have functioning heating. For a full 4 hours, as the clock ticked past midnight and into the early morning hours, we sat in the freezing dark bus as it lumbered down the 401, shivering and wondering what we had gotten ourselves into. Things did not improve upon arrival at the farm. When we finally got there at around 3 a.m, the driver dropped us off at the wrong bunkhouse. It was empty, the beds were all turned upside down, and worst of all, after 4 hours in a freezing bus, the heat was not on. The farm office was closed and no one was inside. The bus driver had already left. We were in a new place in a new country in the middle of the night in the dead of winter. We had no choice but to wait in the frigid bunkhouse until 7 a.m. when the sun peaked above the horizon and workers on the farm began to stir. Only then were we finally directed to our correct bunkhouse, which to our great relief had functioning heating. So Gabriel, your first exposure to Canada was one where, like today, you were exposed to the cold. I was wondering if you could just respond to those experiences of living in those conditions over the course of time, the crowding, sanitation, the privacy, and so on. What was it like? I can't comment on it because I know nothing about it.
Beautiful. Thank you for this opportunity again. In terms of my living conditions, first of all, I would say overcrowding. I lived in a bunkhouse that had 62 guys, 62. And that's one, 62 guys in a bunkhouse. In my room and most of the rooms, with one exception, one room had six, but all the other rooms had eight guys. Eight guys in a room, there were four bunk beds in my room. Well, that was more or less the standard thing. Eight bunk beds, two guys on a bed, and eight guys in a room. For me, a couple of things is I had to use earplugs to to cut out the noise, earplugs. So the noise was one. Privacy was there. That's a given. There's no privacy there. There was one washroom in each room, and literally we have the same work schedule. So you get into use the washroom convenience, right? If you take the kitchen, there were 13 burners. There were three stoves with 13 burners, or 16 burners, sorry, for 62 guys. And do the math, and a lot of the time, well, a convenience again, right? You're not doing things at your own pace. You have to basically line up. If you take lunchtime, because of that, a lot of the guys, they choose to cook food for a couple of days. And during lunchtime, everybody would run to the very limited number of microwaves. There were always less than 10 microwaves. And what is 10? Even though there were 10, what is 10 compared to the ratio of 62 workers, right? So there was always a shortage of inadequate that we never had sufficient appliances, washers, dryers, same thing. There was only one television, and Phil, would you believe me? One television for 62 guys. We were always fighting. The only thing that kept us united was wrestling. Ironically, wrestling kept us united because a lot of us liked it. And so our living conditions was privacy. Imagine in the bunkhouse where I live, there was no internet to communicate with our family. There were two telephones, and those telephones, you could not receive calls. You could only make calls and to make to buy a phone card. And with all those connection fees you have to pay when you use a phone card, the conversation is so short, but working on minimum wage, it did not allow us to, you know, we did not have a lot of disposable income to that would afford us to have long conversation. Not having internet, as I said, was a real restriction. And also I want to tell you at the 4 years that I spent there, 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, during those 4 years, 25% of my weekly income was sent to my government representative. It was called savings, and it was just a tool to make sure that we return home. So imagine working on minimum wage, not getting overtime pay and so on, and 25% of my income have to go to the government. On top of that, we pay the normal deductions, CPP, EI, all the normal deductions, including uniform, including a contribution for housing on minimum wage. So that is why I keep telling people, we do not work for minimum wage. We work for below minimum. You know what's barely minimum? That is what we work for, barely minimum wage.
You've really raised a number of issues there, and I don't know where to start, but I'm going to start with one just because of the emotion that I heard in your voice. And then I might go to Morgan because she's raised an important issue about accommodations. Gabriel, I'm sure that you are familiar with post-traumatic stress disorder. Within the migrant worker communities, is there evidence of those guest workers, is perhaps the best way of putting them, experiencing PTSD as a consequence of many of the things that you've just stated?
Phil, it's not surprising. Last year, a worker was sent home for losing his mind. Just last year. Whilst I was there, we saw lots of cases of that. Alcohol abuse of alcohol, and other drugs, that is evident. For me, I use something. Imagine something I did not, I had moved away from. I had to use it as a form of dealing with cope with the with my challenges. And if you read the book, you'll see what I use. I use religion as a way to just cope with my problem. Something I had moved away from, something I did not want to be identified with, I had to use it. Because all the options available to just cope with the problem, just cope with it, they were very, very, a lot of the options that were open, I did not like them, they did not look positive. And something I did not want to be associated with, religion, I had to use it. And lots of people use lots of things, wayward things, just to cope with it. And being separated from your family is the worst injustice all migrant workers face, regardless where they are. And out of the 20 injustices, if you put all of them together, none of them come that close to being separated from your family and your loved ones.
I've always said that if there is ever a dependency for someone who has a dependency, I believe, as much as I would not say that I'm a deeply religious person, that religion is probably the one dependency that will help people to get out of a vicious cycle of substance abuse. And I would never, ever stop anybody from developing that dependency if it helps in any way. And I just want to switch to that because I think it's worthwhile to tell people, as you did in the book, about your name. I think it's a great name, and there's so much in the name, Gabriel Aladua.
Yeah, I like to tell people that I discovered in Canada many, many things in Canada. One, I discovered I'm a god. Two, I discovered that I'm an angel. Three, I discovered that I'm a slave. Four, I discovered I'm half human. Five, I discovered I'm a lab rat. Let me go to God. My surname, Aladua, Allah. Allah is the Muslim name for God. And I got that name from my father's side. And my father is the descendant of indentured workers. And indentured workers came after emancipation because slavery was so barbaric in the Caribbean. After emancipation, the then freed slaves had an option whether to continue working on the plantation or go on their own. Slavery was so barbaric that they left the plantation. So the plantation owners had a problem, a plantation with very little or no workers. So they then went to Asia to bring in indentured workers. And my father's name is just one of the few things that made indentured workers different to slaves. Let me go to Gabriel, Angel Gabriel. And I'm pretty sure you cannot see my wings right now because somebody made me the angel because they used my labor to create their heaven. Somebody created their heaven on earth, on this earth, and they're using my labor to create their heaven. And with slavery, and my mother is of African descent, with slavery, what happened? Everything that was important to us, our language, our culture, our food, our everything that was stripped away, taken away from us. And their colonizers imposed their way of life on us. They imposed their religion on us. And my labor in Canada is being used to subsidize the lifestyle of a few. I want to tell people, I consider myself having three legs. One, I carry the leg of slavery from my mother's side. Two, I carry the leg of indentured labor from my father's side. And three, I am in Canada participating in another form of exploitation, another form of exploited labor. So I tell people I have three legs. So let me continue about the conversation. A slave, the difficult working and living conditions in Canada, it is hidden. It is outside of people's outs because we're forced to be quiet. So I'm hoping that this book will bring it out. I'm hoping that Migrant Dreams, people will watch it. I'm hoping that El Contracto, people will watch it. Half human, and as I was trying to point out, enshrined in Canadian law, we are denied the right to participate in family life, denied the right to be protected by all. That makes us half a human being in Canada. A lab rat, I want to say, we are here temporarily in Canada from 1966 to now, 57 years. We are still temporary. The federal government that's in office in the previous election, they won on the platform of real change. What song are they singing to the public right now? The new reality. Instead of they talking about the real change, the new reality. And what's the new reality? Short-term employment, short-term contract. And these are things that they've tried on us, and they're bringing it out to mainstream employment. And I want to tell you, we are lab rats, they've tried it on us, and now they're bringing it to mainstream employment. So the point is, our issues are related to your issues. Do not think that it's just migrant workers' issues. Our issues are related to Canadian society issues.
Okay. There are a number of areas that I'm going to go to, but before I do that, Morgan raised a point, and I wonder if she could put it into question form about the kinds of housing that we might see in the Tillsonburg Simcoe area. Morgan, if you could just raise that question, perhaps Gabriel can respond to it so we can see what that's all about.
Hi, Gabriel. Thank you so much for taking the time to educate all of us a little bit more. I spent a lot of time going back and forth to Lake Erie. So I saw the transformation that happened, especially around the Tillsonburg area, where it moved from everything being a tobacco farm to now a lot of ginseng and soy. One of the things that I noticed was happening is some of the old tobacco huts, as the farms got some of the newer drying huts of the tobaccos for the tobacco, what they'd do is they'd convert the old tobacco shacks into housing for the workers. And I had opportunity to speak to some of the workers, because on Friday, if you were in Tillsonburg, you knew it was payday because all of the migrant workers were there on their bicycles, because that was their only form of transportation to get in somewhere to be able to buy the things that they needed to buy because they were so isolated out on the farms. So what kind of living conditions could you imagine would be in a converted tobacco hut made of wood? Was that ever something that you personally experienced, or have you spoken to people that lived in those old wooden tobacco huts?
I want to say thank you so much for that. The fact that you invest your time in that, it means that you have an interest in it, and you know it's something close to your heart and your society. Thank you for that. I want to say during the pandemic, Trinidadians were caught stranded in Canada. Imagine those Trinidadians have been coming to Canada for years. And what is it? They come on the 8-month program at the end of the contracts, normally September, October, November, after the harvesting of tobacco, apples, whatever the crop is, they'll go back home. A lot of them I know, they live in Tillsonburg area. So during imagine after your contract has ended, you cannot go home because no flights are allowed in Trinidad. Can you imagine that? Now, listen to that. Number one, those workers, number one, the contract has ended. That's one. What does that mean? They're not working. They're not earning an income. That's one. Number two, they've never, ever spent winter in Canada. So they do not have the clothing. Number three, some of the houses, because it is customary at the end of the contract, they go back. Some of the houses I saw, they're not equipped to face winter with heating and so on, because during winter, the workers are not there. That's what they were accustomed to, right? So some of the houses do not have heating, which is what the point that you just raised there. So to convert those things, the standards, right? And number four, I want to touch quickly. These workers, they could not get EI because the contract has ended. And in Canada, imagine from 1966 to now, we pay into EI, we can't access EI. Why we can't access EI? As in the case of the Trinidadian workers, when the contract ends, when our contract ends, we have to go back home. So to access EI, you have to be available in the country, available for work, blah, blah, blah. So the workers, the contract has ended, they cannot access EI. So it was a real situation. But going back to the issue of housing, some of the houses I saw, they were modified to accommodate the workers, and heating was one of them. And that is a serious issue. The poor heating, especially I witnessed that firsthand during the pandemic when the Trinidadian workers were caught stranded in Canada. In addition to that, and in Migrant Dreams again, in the housing that was highlighted, it was a garage where huge garage where the farmer would store his equipment, farm equipment. It was converted into housing. Now, if you see, I don't know, I just want to draw your attention to Migrant Dreams. If you see that, it will draw the point that housing is one of the there's very little standards when it comes to workers' housing. I must say though, in Leamington where I work, there's a big push for all those new greenhouses to build new bunk houses. They look on the out. The farmers are so proud of the new looks for those bunk houses that those bunk houses, they're right next to the main road. It's so easy to see. Beautiful. They look beautiful. But trust me, this is as a result of the pressure and advocacy that we do. But however, I'm quick to point out that when you go in those bunk houses, it is still overcrowded and it is still the kind of appliances that are in there. It is still not, if you look at the ratio, generally most of these new bunk houses, they have two bedrooms. Each bedroom has a capacity of 12 workers, so 24 workers. And there are two, those that have been in, they have eight burners. So eight burners for 24 workers and two washers, two dryers. You know, the ratio is not, the ratio is a problem. That's a long answer to a short question.
That's a great answer. Thank you. Because I want to segue to COVID. In your book, there is some discussion of the inconsistencies of support for migrant workers during the COVID crisis. And what I think is very interesting is you juxtapose how COVID affected migrant workers and how it affected the economy of your home country, St. Lucia. But first of all, I just want to read from this, where Ed, your editor, asked you the question about the response of governments. And you said, the response of various governments was varied. Let me start with housing. In Norfolk County, the chief medical officer wanted to have 3 workers per bunkhouse. The farmers pushed back because they thought it was an inefficient use of bunkhouses. Municipal governments have not done much and have always acted in favor of employers. Ontario has never provided us with the hazard pay that it provided to other frontline workers. That shows that migrant workers are in a different class. Every level of government has been giving lip service but not taking action. The fact that the federal government opened the border for migrant workers highlights how important migrant workers are to the economy. With high unemployment, I thought Canadians would work on the farms. But Canadians still do not want to do that work because conditions are neither attractive nor just. The federal government policies are geared toward putting food on Canadians' tables, not creating the conditions that are attractive for workers. They do things that favor the profits of employers and not the well-being of workers. So let's unpack that, and then let's go to the tourism economy of St. Lucia and elsewhere, because I think that that's another side of not just the migrant worker experience, but the north-south disparity as well. Can you comment on the different living conditions, because I know it's different in Leamington to what it is in Norfolk County, to what it is for migrant workers working in Tim Hortons in Regina, Saskatchewan. How do we contrast all those experiences?
At the end of the day, our vulnerability is tied in a tied work permit. I'm being tied to my employer. The burden is on me to please my employer. I use energy drinks just to meet my employer's expectation. I cut out my break, my lunch hour. It was my choice, but just to meet because of the pressure, my employer's expectation, to basically cement or to guarantee myself a spot to come back next year. I cut my lunch hour usually by 20 or 30 minutes. Washroom breaks, I would forego that just to meet my employer's expectation. If you look at the north-south disparity, let me tell you a couple of things. According to that popular song in the Caribbean, all we have is S-S-S. The C, S-E-A, the sand, S-A-N-D, and the S-U-N. And I can see the sun is flashing on you right now, right? That's all we have, right? S-S-S. So we don't have a lot of natural resources, right? So we depend on for example, in my country, when we moved from sugarcane, we moved, imagine sugarcane. With sugarcane, you can only harvest that crop once for the year. So you have only one income for the year. We moved from sugarcane to bananas. With bananas, the moment you start harvesting bananas, you can harvest at least twice for the month. So the cash flow is different compared to sugarcane. So when we move from sugarcane to bananas, it revolutionized. It was like an economic revolution. But through the WTO, and the World Bank and other institutions. These are institutions that are there to keep that wide divide between the developed and the developing countries. These are institutions that are in place to create that wide divide, to maintain that wide divide. And what is that wide divide? What does some developed countries want? Cheap labor, cheap materials, disposable labor. What do they want? Resource extraction. What do they want? Free trade. What do they want? They also want tax havens. Where do they have that? In the global south. To keep that wide divide, that is, these are institutions that maintain that. What do they want? Cheap labor, disposable labor. Where are those workers from Tim Hortons, you name, where are they coming from? From the global south, from the child. I'm 50 years old. From the time I was a child, I keep hearing we are developing country. When will we ever develop? because those institutions are there to maintain that white divide, perpetuate it. Our vulnerability is tied in a tight work permit. Right now, Phil, there's that war in Ukraine. Canada is saying any amount is welcome in Canada, any amount. Have you ever heard of that before? Any amount. Why? They are one of us. When it comes to any other country in the global south, 4,000. There's always a ceiling. There's always a limit. What does that mean? The system, the Canadian immigration system is racist. There's no running away from that. And if you go back to the farmers that are owning most of the farms, if not all the farms right now, most of them, if not all of them, are from Europe. When they come here post-World War II, when they came here with getting landed. They got status upon arrival. They even got land. It's not something new we're talking about there, status upon arrival. It's not something new. It's something Canada has done. But because of race, and I know some people who would hear that, there are 5 days. Some people, they'll downplay that. They do not want to comment. They'll downplay it. Some people will deny it. Some people will deflect the conversation. Some people will derail it.
And I want to just carry on with that, because I think that there are a couple of points here that are very important. I know that my good friend Jim Estill has worked very hard on bringing refugees to Canada from places like Afghanistan. And he does lament exactly what you said about the open door for those from the Ukraine, whereas the door for people that assisted Canada in Afghanistan was quietly shut. And that I think is important to be recognized. But I don't want this whole discussion to be a complete downer. And there's a couple of things. I'm going to try to pull a couple of comments together from Joe and Tanya. Joe and Tanya basically have said, it surely cannot be all bad. Because why would anybody want to come to Canada to work on farms? And why would they return?
Yes, it cannot be all bad. That's a conversation I hear all the time. It cannot be all bad. You know why? The farm owners who came to Canada, they came here, they got landed, they got status, they got land. It cannot be all bad. It cannot be all bad. It cannot be all bad because the system is unjust. It cannot be all bad. And that's what we're saying. On the world stage, in my home country, red and white means love. And on the world stage, that's what Canada is saying. If you're in a difficult situation, come. You're in Ukraine, there's war. Come and have a new start. You're in Afghanistan, you're in Syria, wherever. Come and have a new start. On the world stage, that's what Canada is saying. It cannot be all bad. It cannot be all bad. That's what they say. It cannot, but it can be good for some and it cannot be good for others. That is the problem. If I had to come back to the farm program, I would. You know why? You know why? Canada is a country with a culture of silence. Nobody speaks about it. It's always denied. Oh, it's in America. It's not that bad. It's denied. We live in a country that denies the truth. We live in a country that is whitewashing the truth, erasing the truth. The average person knows about the Underground Railroad system in Canada. The average person knows that. The average person does not know the injustices behind the food. And I want to tell you, Let us face the facts. It is said Canada controls over 50, maybe 75% of the world's supply of fresh water. Anything over 50%. Right now, at this very second, do you know how many communities are on the boil water advisory? Is it a question of resources or is it a question of who is controlling it? Isn't that a fact? Isn't that a fact?
Yeah.
Isn't that a fact that there's a call to action? The Truth and Reconciliation Commission is calling on you and calling on me to do 94 things to make right those injustices. Isn't that a fact? Isn't that a fact? The residential schools lasted over 100 years. And they said even right now in foster care, there are even more children in foster care than during residential school period. Isn't that a fact? Isn't that a fact? That the Chinese railroad workers were used, abused, and refused. Isn't that a fact? What kind of work were the Chinese railroad workers are asked to do? The dirty, difficult. And it is said at the monument, over 17,000 came in, roughly one in four died because of the dirty work. And what happened? What kind of treatment did they get? Isn't that a fact? Isn't that a fact that the home children. And based on recent things I've been coming across, it is said that the current population, 1 in 25, I think, of the Canadian population is a descendant of the home children. Can you imagine the abuses of those children? Children from orphanages brought to Canada. Can you imagine the exploitation of these people? Isn't that a fact? Isn't that a fact that our society was built on free, cheap, disposable labor? And the Canadian, the farm program right now is still a continuum. Isn't that a fact? Who would want to deny it? But again, we live in a country with a culture of silence. And that is why I welcome this opportunity. The truth is hidden in Canada. And that is what the pandemic did. It kind of put, it forced mainstream media to put the camera on the issues that face migrant workers.
And I think that's very important that you've given that history of Canadian immigration and Canadian exploitation of workers in the past. For those that aren't familiar with the Home Children was a program that brought orphans to Canada, oftentimes from inner cities in England, to work on farms. When I was growing up, we had a neighbor who was a home child who developed a stutter as a consequence of the abuse that he experienced. He was brought over and basically he was an indentured servant to a particular farm. It's a program that many people aren't familiar with. Juxtapose that with my grandmother who came to Northern Ontario from England, from Liverpool. They were a family with dreams, migrant dreams. They received a piece of land in the Dryden Wabagoon area, and her husband had filled her with promises, and he said it was a land of milk and honey. Well, when she got to Canada, and she was both Jewish and a midwife, which I think is important. When she got here, she said, "Well, you promised me milk and honey. So where's the milk and the honey? All I see is snow and ice." And the history of Canada, from moments like that to the settlers in sheepskin coats to the home children, has been one that has been very, very inconsistent. But as we deal with that, let's get to some of the circumstances that currently affect migrant workers today who do not necessarily have the right to permanent residency in Canada. Both Jonathan and others asked Gabriel, how did you come to get your landed immigrant status, and how do some others go about getting theirs?
Okay, a couple of things. Thank you for that. I admire your effort to keep the conversation balanced. I admire your knowledge of the past. That's important. And the past is important to discuss about where we are and where we're going. That's important. I like that very much. How did I become a permanent resident? I want to tell you, in Canada, the average Canadian, when you talk about status, landed, PR, whatever, to an average Canadian, it simply means the immigration pact, living in Canada. That's what it means, right? I want to tell you, in Canada, status means two things. It's a two-edged sword. If I have immigration, if I have status, it takes care of my immigration vulnerability, yes. But you know the other important thing for migrant worker? If I have status, I have an open work permit. You know what does that mean, Phil? If I have an open work permit, by having status, I can work anywhere that's willing to hire me. If my employer know I can work anywhere that's willing to hire me, it puts the pressure on my employer to create just and fair conditions to attract me and to keep me, right? And Canadians do not want they're short-sighted on that part, that status is a two-edged sword. They focus on the one edge of being able to live here and so on. But the other edge is our labor vulnerabilities, and I want to emphasize that. I don't even know if I can overemphasize that. How did I become a permanent resident? One of the pillars of the program, we cannot apply for status. How did that happen? I fell through a crack. That's what it is. And what does that mean? In 2014, under Stephen Harper, he had that program. We call it the four-in, four-out rule. What does that mean? The workers who are on the two-year contracts, once you spend two contracts in Canada, so 2 years and 2 years, 4 years, once you spend 4 years, his policy was go back home, spend 4 years before you can qualify to come back in Canada. So we call it the four-in, four-out. That was in 2014. That was during the time I was on the farm program. There was a radio program about that. Lots of people were talking about it, how unjust and so on it was. One day, there was an immigration lawyer talking about it. I told myself, if she was good enough to be on the radio, she must be good enough to guide me. So I decided to call her. I made an appointment. When I went to her, she said, I cannot do this. I cannot apply for this. I cannot apply for this. There's only one little avenue. HNC, humanitarian and compassionate. Humanitarian and compassionate. And what is humanitarian and compassionate? That is one avenue that very, very few people, they said it's just either 1 in 4 or 1 in 10 people will get through with that. It's a slow process, long process. And humanitarian, as it says, it's not a scoring thing. It is just based on somebody's opinion. Yes, that guy should be here or no. Just that. There's no, you must get 80%, a pass mark of 80 or a score of 80 out of 100. No, it's just somebody's opinion. And that was it. And how did I get to know about that? I went to a garage sale and I thought I went to a garage sale. That just by going to the garage sale, that opened a whole new world to me. By going to the garage sale, that's where I found my Canadian dad. That's where I found my Canadian mom. I went to a garage sale, and up to this day, I'm still have the opportunity to sleep at that person's home. I thought I went to a garage sale. That person gave me a used radio cassette player, And at that time in the bungalows, because we had one television, some guys bought portable DVD, portable MP3 and so on, right? I had a used radio cassette. It was a little outdated, but trust me, that used radio cassette player, that was my key to coming to live in Canada. It was on that radio I heard that radio program. Otherwise, I would have never been, connected with that program. And that's just, in a nutshell, that's how I became a permanent resident.
Thank you for that. Now, the next thing that has really intrigued me, and I've never, ever asked you this, how did you become activist in resident at the University of Guelph? This is quite the journey that you've had.
To be honest, that's the most difficult question you can ask me, because that happened. A lot of things happened behind the scenes, which I don't know. However, what was clear is that bold decision I made to speak about fair and just conditions. My work is very clear, it's out in the open. So who worked behind the scene for that to happen? I'm not sure. However, two things I would say. One, there's that professor who since passed, Kerry Prebisch. She laid the foundation for that to happen. That's one. And number two, I want to tell you, Guelph is not just a city or just a university or just whatever. Guelph is the capital. I call it the capital. That is where all the big players in agriculture are located. You name OFA, that's where they are. Ministry of Agriculture, WSI, all the players, that is where they are. I want to tell you, the University of Guelph, they honored, what's his name? Ken Forth. Who is Ken Forth? He's the one, maybe the biggest advocate for the status quo. And what is the status quo? Exploitation of people of color. They honored it, honorary degree. So I'm telling you, to create a fair society, we need to bring change. Talking about it is one thing. Guelph is the capital. That is where all the policies are being created, all the policies that maintain those exploitation. And my work, which is to challenge the status quo and create change. That is, it's clear that I've been an advocate. And remember, being a former migrant worker, having the lived experience of it, who is a better person to confront the capital? I call it the capital, the heartbeat of the status quo. Who did the work behind the scenes? I'm not sure, but somebody who lived it, worked in it, breathed it, is the best person to challenge the status quo. And as I said to Kerry Prebisch, she laid the foundation, because when migrant justice was food justice was a non-issue, nobody wanted to face it. She was the one who pioneered that. And where did that happen? At Guelph. Nobody, from what I know, nobody wanted to talk about it. Nobody wanted to touch it. She was the one. So she laid the foundation for that. And I am happy that as a result of her work, because the founding members of Justice for Migrant Workers, they were all been molded or influenced by the work of Kerry. And I am an offspring of Kerry's work. So in a nutshell, I hope that answers it.
It certainly does, Gabriel. And as our time winds up, I truly want to thank you for this food for thought. This has been not comfortable for many of us, and very, very challenging. And these are the things that we need at all times of day, all times of year. This gives us much to think about as we ponder food security in Canada and those who provide for our food support locally. We always say that we should think globally and act locally, and clearly, migrant workers, in some senses, some ironic senses, unite the local and the global, but not necessarily in a comfortable fashion. You've given us much to think about. I'm once again going to promote Harvesting Freedom and encourage people to consider watching both Migrant Dreams and El Contracto. They're not hard to find online. And as I do that, as I said, a hearty applause to you. We wish you the best in the work that you are doing, raising awareness of the experiences of migrant workers in Canada and the need to improve those experiences over not the long term, but the short term. A hearty thank you to you, Gabriel. And if you want to stay around, we have announcements now about events that are coming up that we hope raise awareness on other things, including, as you said, water security, which I think will be one of those things that we're tackling in the very soon future. Tanya, over to you. Thanks, Gabriel.
Okay, so we have several announcements. There is the Welcome Back Doug Ford Rally. It's at Queen's Park, and it's on February the 25th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Join us as we stand up for I Heed, Indigenous peoples, health, education, the environment, and democracy. The Circular Store grand opening is at Quebec Street Mall on February the 11th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. The ribbon cutting is at noon, and there will be the Repair Cafe and a free beeswax wrap workshop. Wellington Water Watchers presents Watershed 3, a convention for water justice, on February the 11th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Please Google Wellington Water Watchers Watershed 3. Have your say about improved transit, walking and biking infrastructure, tourism, and more. GCAT has a survey available. Please Google GCAT survey. There is a webinar series with regard to highway planning. It starts on February 9th and goes until May 4th. Breezy Breakfasters get a 10% discount, the code being G as in George, B as in Breezy, B as in Breakfast, 44. Please go to transportfutures.ca/highway for more information. The North End Harvest Market Quarter Auction Fundraiser is being held on Saturday, March the 18th at Trinity United Church on 400 Stevenson Street. The doors open at 1 p.m. and the auction begins at 2 p.m. It's $5 for the first bidding paddle and $4 for additional bidding paddles. For more information, please contact Barb at 519-835-1016. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we will hear a Green Belt update with Mike Marcolongo. And with that, I believe it is a wrap. Thank you.
Thanks, Tanya, and thanks everyone for listening. Again, thanks, Gabriel. And Gabriel, hope to see you in Guelph soon. And we always have a place for you to stay at our house. Take care, everyone.
Thank you so much for this great opportunity. I welcome it. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into this week's discussion about the state of the migrant worker program in Canada. Special thanks to Gabriel Aladua, the University of Guelph's first activist in residence. Music was provided by Jules Jerome. This podcast was produced by Breezy student worker, me, Longfei Chen. Breezy Breakfast, we work hard to give you food for thought. See you next week.